Wanted to share a bit about the subject of this retreat, of form and formless. The formless being in classical Buddhist terms described more as the unconditioned, what's not programming, non-self. And I'll start with a poem. This is Rumi, isn't it? Yeah. From Rumi, the Sufi poet. It's rigged, everything in your favour. So there is nothing to worry about. Is there some position you want? Some office? Some acclaim? Some award? Some con? Some lover? Maybe two, maybe three, maybe four, all at once. Maybe a relationship with God. I know there is a gold mine in you. When you find it, the wonderment of the earth's gifts, you will lay aside as naturally as does a child a doll. But dear, how sweet you look to me kissing the unreal. Comfort, fulfill yourself in any way possible. Do that until you ache, then come to me again. Shall I read it again? Yeah. It's rigged. Everything in your favour. So there is nothing to worry about. Is there some position you want? Some office, some acclaim, some award, some con, some lover, maybe two, maybe three, maybe four, all at once. Maybe a relationship with God. I know there is a gold mine in you. When you find it, the wonderment of the earth's gifts, you will lay aside as naturally as does a child a doll. But dear, how sweet you look to me, kissing the unreal. Comfort, fulfill yourself in every way possible. Do that until you ache. Then come to me again. So why do we meditate? Why do we do this funny thing we do here? I think most people's reasons change along the way. Normally we come looking for some release from kind of daily sufferings, pushed by an undercurrent of, as Sumedha was mentioning, the more existential the sufferings. And my feeling is that meditation is really for making some space around all of this so that we can quieten down the sense of self. This is the real purpose. And on the way, it helps our well-being, you know, it helps us emotionally and mentally and, you know, psychologically and everything. But for me, the real sense of it is to quieten down the ego. And I find it's a nice reminder that, of what that purpose is. Some years ago, I was coming back, I was bringing my nephew back from school in London, where I stop in sometimes, and he was 3 years old then. And we stopped in the park to play for a bit, you know, like you do. And there was just me and him there, and then this woman came. And she went on the swings, and she was standing up on the swings. And she was maybe in her 70s. And she was from somewhere Southeast Asia. I can't say exactly where. But the culture that normally women aren't out that much alone, and they're not on swings, and they're not standing up. And she was having such a good time. She was standing on the swing, and she was swinging, you know, like when you're a kid, and you want to go all the way over, you know? So you swing to the maximum that way, and then you swing to the maximum that way, and swing that way. And I said to my nephew, Jeremy, come here. And my first reaction, I'm embarrassed to say now, was, oh dear, she's a bit crazy, you know? So come here quick. And then he held my hand and we watched her. And she kept on turning to us with this smile and this smile, with these shining eyes and this huge smile of total delight, ecstasy, freedom and all of that, you know? And I was like, wow, wow. A taste of freedom, you know? And maybe it was just that she was, I don't know what, I don't know. I don't want to go into it, you know, what she could be. But I'd already been into spiritual practice for quite a while, you know, when this happened. And when I first started out, I took it very seriously, being a Buddhist, you know. It's like I took out my membership card, you know, like for the Communist Party. And I put on this model of how one should be. Oh, I should be compassionate. Oh, okay. You know, and I tried these things. And I think it was probably a bit stiff, you know, and a lot of friends of mine just kind of went, loon, you know. When you get over it, phone us again, you know. Because I was kind of trying this model of a perfect spiritual person, you know. And so for some years there was this, like this spiritual persona, you know? Like this model I was trying to fit into. It wasn't actually very real or comfortable. And I think seeing this woman on the swing was maybe it had started before, but it became much more clear to me then, the beginning to crack this kind of model thing, you know, and to maybe come from much deeper inside rather than an exterior thing. And the beginning of understanding how one can get on a spiritual path and create a self from that, an identity. So we're leaving our old identity behind and we put a new costume on, you know, of a nice person that smiles and whatever. And I think that I began to see the cracking of that, and to feel the identity thing that one can get around spirituality. Even though my first Dharma teacher had said, you be careful of that, you know. She used to say it to us regularly. And we didn't take any notice, you know. So even I think this sense of like we could meditate for 30 years and we could be quite good at it, actually. And we could be developing quite a strong sense of self from that, from that we're good at it. By, like, you know, things calming down a bit more well-being, a bit more ease and stuff, and then start to go, I'm good at this, I'm a good meditator, and I'm this and that. And we're building, again, a construct. We're building a self-image inside us of who we are. And I'm not saying to not be good at meditation, you know what I mean? I'm just saying that it is possible to go down that path as well, and spend the whole life, 150 years meditating and be strengthening our ego, be strengthening our sense of self and become a super meditator who gets up at 5 and I can meditate for 12 hours like the one that Sumedha was talking about the other day. But except she wanted a cup of tea at 5 o'clock, hey? Eish. The tea addiction, one of the greatest. So what is it, this sense of self? What is it, this thing that Buddhists talk about, non-self and all of this? So maybe I'll approach that from some few different directions. Because then maybe different people have different understandings, different ways of taking that in, on. But one is that that feeling when someone slams the door, or the wind suddenly slams the door, and you get that clutching feeling, you know, inside. There's a like this. There's a very strong sense of tightness, of meanness, being a bit shocked, and it's just the wind has slammed the door, you know. But that's one way. And there are so many ways to go into this. A lot through emotions. Like strong emotions, like we have a neighbour in the south of France, a very good neighbour, he's a very generous guy, who, it's like he takes up, he lives indignation like it's coffee, you know? He also drinks a lot of coffee, but hey. So he really gets into indignation. And I think it gives him energy, you know, it gives him quite a lot of energy. And when you go to visit him, he goes, run, run, it's not fair, this, run, 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 for half an hour.
Can you specify indignation? What does it mean?
When you're indignant about something, well, it shouldn't be like that, and, you know, this kind of thing. And there can be a lot of energy in that. And it's like anger. There can be a lot of energy in anger and some of these strong emotions. And it's not to say that often we need these strong emotions. There's an appropriate time and place for anger, that's for sure, you know. Sometimes we need to say no and make our boundaries clear and we need to be indignant. What are you doing, you know? But there is also that is feeding, solidifying this inner sense of self. And like Ajahn Amaro, who's the abbot of the monastery we used to live in, he said once, I think he was quoting someone else, he said, saying I have an anger issue is like deflecting the problem. It's like displacing the problem. Instead of saying I have a sense of self, a solid self problem, you know. That those strong emotions can get us so believing in a perception of ourself that's not quite real, not quite right. And neither are other people's perceptions of you or yours of others quite accurate, you know? And yet we're so convinced of our perceptions of ourself and our perceptions of others. We can be so convinced that we're right about that person, that they're like that. And then someone else will come and say, oh no, I find them very not like that at all, and da-di-da, you know. We're not quite our perceptions that we think we are. And that's, it's worth taking time to ponder this, how we see each other, how we create each other and that. There's often what we do with a strong emotion often is like something comes up. I know this is slightly difficult to get a hold on, but a strong emotion comes up, and somehow we put it in the pot called me. You know? We're convinced in that moment of the meanness of that strong feeling. And often people say, don't take it personally. It's so aggravating when people say that, isn't it? No? Because when you're having a difficult feeling, you're having it. It feels like that, hey, and that feeling is really real. But it's not you in essence. And it's almost like we have a computer, you know, and we're putting, each time we have an emotion, we're filing it under me to create a sense of self. Yeah, that's freaky stuff. And there's a lot of different ways, but yeah, strong feelings of unfairness can bring this up stronger. And that can be helpful to recognize it. That's where the old Tibetan practice of Lojong, working with adversity, really helps. The more difficult things are, the more that feeling comes up, the more I can recognize it and get to know it and not believe in it. Let it go. One of the ways that the Tibetans see it, this is an old description of the sense of self, from my first Dharma teacher in the Tibetan tradition. And this is like, say you have a BMW, yeah? The BMW is made up of wheels, with rubber on the wheels, of a gearbox, of oil, of all these different parts. And all together, it's a BMW car. But you can't find BMW in each part. You know? Even if the gearbox is, for BMW, is made in a special BMW way, once you go inside that, you're going to find more concepts. You're going to find a cog that does a cog that does a cog that does a lever that does some oil there that, you know. So each time you're coming more into a construction of concepts, even the wheel, hey, is made with the hub and the axle that meets and the round bit in the middle and the tire is made from rubber plus this, plus this, plus this. And it's just to compare that we're a mix like that of different parts. But in each of our different parts, we can't really find a meanness, a solid identity that doesn't move. If you really look, you just can't find it. And we're not cars, I know that. And cars are made, tailor-made, manufactured. And human beings, each one is unique. But still, the how we're creating this sense of self is really dependent on our conditions. Like where we're born, our culture, our education, how we've been brought up, the things that have happened to us, gender, race, all sorts of things come into that sense of there being a solid me here. But it's all these components. It's like the car. It's all these different parts, different experiences, genetics, all sorts of things coming in to create this. And like a car, we the car does exist, hey, because we can use it, we can get in and we can drive. And the same with the humans, you know, we exist in a way, but not as we perceive it, not as solidly as we think. We're not as much me as we think we are. And there's changingness. Our conditions change, how we view things change, which changes our whole outlook on things, our perceptions. So there's a whole lot of fluidity going on there. And I found it really helpful when I first encountered these teachings. I was still smoking cigarettes, you know, and I was convinced of my identity as an addicted person to nicotine. And with those teachings on non-self, I found that I slowly, over a year of smoking conscientiously, every last bit of tar into my lungs, in full awareness. It was so horrible. Such a gruesome time. And I'd promised myself I wouldn't smoke in my caravan, you know, because I hated the smell by then, and my hair and my hands, ugh, how disgusting. So I smoked for a year, in full consciousness. And really, really worked with this sense of self, of being an addicted smoker. With all that goes with that, you know, all the, I can't give up, I'm not strong enough, and I need to be strong, and I'm no good, and all of that, because I've tried so many times, and it doesn't work. And seeing through all of that blah blah, that belief in this person that didn't really exist. And so when I finally did give up, it was so easy. I just stopped one day and I didn't suffer any more from it. Even though all the other times I'd really suffered from trying to give up. Because I thought it was about willpower, you know. But there, this seeing through the sense of identity that I was a nicotine addict. And then suddenly didn't believe it. Didn't believe the illusion anymore. I was like, oh, okay. It was so easy. That really helped me to understand those teachings more than anything. Does that make sense up to now? Yeah? Good. So the last few years, Sumedha and I have been building a meditation hall at our retreat place. It's not really ours, though, is it? It's the people's.
It's the trees.
Eh?
The trees.
And the trees. And our cat, who's our spiritual guide. And we've been building an ecological meditation room with straw bales and clay and stuff. And so you kind of build a basic structure, and then you put straw bales and you kind of put them in with wood so that they don't move. And then you put one layer of clay, and then you fill in all the holes and the gaps. And then you'd put another layer and another layer, and we've still got another layer to put. And I feel like that's a little bit what we do with this solidifying of who we think we are. This solidifying who we think others are. So it's a bit like that. We're filling in, you know. We have a skeletal form that we start out with, you know, of coming from one country and being, for some people, one gender, you know, this kind of thing. And then we fill it in and fill it in and fill it in until we're really convinced of being something quite solid. And inside the straw bales, there's just air. It's Yeah, good insulation though. So a nice way to go about it is, I find, with strong emotions, to start with that, when you have a strong feeling, to really welcome it and to taste, even if it's a sort of overwhelming sort, to taste the flavor of it, like the inside flavor, and to check out, is there any, fill in the blank, noonness in there, you know? That's what I would do for myself, and then you fill in with your own name, you know, or meanness in there. Because when we're really sitting, it's like pain, when we're really sitting inside, like knee pain, there it's knee painness, it's not noonness really. And that's, I find that really fascinating, to go right inside. Right, inside the emotions to find their impersonality, actually. And it's only then, from doing that, that I find that thing where people say, don't take it personally, in that aggravating way. It's only then that that makes sense, you know, that our emotions are not personal. And it doesn't mean to discard them and not take them seriously, that they don't need, that our heart doesn't need caring for, you know? But that thing of totally believing them to be me, through that being very aware in a moment of strong emotions, can really help that. Sometimes I find that emotions go a strong feeling. It can be like wide at the top up here, and then it goes down, you know, like a mudslide in South America that you hear about, you know, or the other way, starting like this and going. So to actually be really present, feeling that almost the blood in the body going with a really strong emotion. And feeling into it in that moment, is this me? Is there really a flavor that I could say is me in there? And I find not. And this was this meditation, Lowry, that I was speaking about the other day to you of when we were dropping and dropping and dropping through into seatedness, and we come to a resistance and we let go and we go through it, and another one, and we come to tensions and we keep letting go until what is holding on still, when we keep dropping into relaxation, into deep meditation. And I often find it's my perception of a sense of self that is the resistance. And so to feel that resistance, and what is it? What does it taste like? Oh, it tastes like my perception of meanness. Oh, and it's just like a translucent spider's web. You can still keep going through it, you know, because it doesn't really exist. So in classical Buddhism, back to the book, there's a way of describing it that's of what we trip up over, what trip ups there are. Is that okay in non-Finnish, in English? Because if that's a difficult word, I could find another one. Hey? Like a trip up, things that trip you up. You know, when you're walking along and there's a root and you don't see it. And then you fall.
Combustible.
Yeah. Something like that. The trip ups from this really strong belief in the sense of self are in Buddhist terms the three cravings, the three tanhas. And that one of them comes from a craving, like a wanting, for the sense pleasure things. Everything to do with the eyes, the nose, I want something beautiful, I want to taste something, I want to feel something, I want to, all of this, hear something, and the getting stuck to that. Not that sense pleasures are in any way evil, but when we get stuck with the Velcro onto them or super glue, we want to keep it and we want to hold on to it, it gets difficult, life. So that's a brief one of the first one. And the second one is a wish to become. The craving, the need to become something. Which is a little bit what this poem was about, What do you want? Do you want a special medal? Do you want a claim? What do you want in this life? One or two lovers? Do you want God, What specialness do you want? It's very mundane often, the need to become. It happens to us all the time, that the becoming thing. And I think that actually that's what, or in part, what the Buddha was talking about, speaking of rebirth. Even if there is, also the culture in Hinduism of a cycle of rebirth and all of that scenario. My sense is that he was more speaking of how we're being reborn in each moment into a new sense of self. How we keep adding our experience into our sense of self to solidify that sense. And there's the other one. The third one is the craving for unbecoming. So that's the kind of opposite thing of just of wanting to disappear, wanting to not manifest in our life. When it's just too much and we want to just disappear from life. We want to walk out on the difficulties and the challenges. Does that resonate something? I think we all have all three of them going on at different moments, in different degrees, and that. I know for me, I certainly have done and do all three of those on a regular basis. That.
Can you say the third one again?
The third one, unbecoming, the craving to not be, to disappear out of my life.
What's the first one again?
The craving for sense pleasures. So all of the things to do with the six senses. So these are the things we get stuck to, like those things in fairgrounds, where you go against a wall and they turn it and then you stay. I've never actually been in one of these, but I've heard about them. Yeah? Anyone ever been in one of those? And because of the centrifugal force, you've been in one, yeah? Oh, how was it?
Fun.
It was fun. Yeah, yeah. And you're actually stuck to the wall, yeah?
Depends how fast it goes.
Yeah, yeah.
If it goes really fast, it's hard.
Yeah. So yeah, this kind of centrifugal force that when we get stuck on one of these three cravings, pins us to the wall. We can't get off till somebody presses the button. And that's the habit, hey. And I suppose you could say what's generating the electricity for that is our habits and programmings, you know, our conditionings, how we keep going, being lived through our habits and programmings. And that can come from all sorts of pretty mundane, ordinary things, you know. Our habits can come from, you know, how we grew up and our culture and, you know, that male-female stuff going on. I mean, I've seen some amazing stuff in that sort of programming, like a cousin of mine, my youngest cousin at 19, he put diesel in a chainsaw instead of two-stroke. You're supposed to put a mixture. But because everybody was convinced he's a boy, of course he knows how to work a chainsaw. And he was convinced, I'm a boy, so of course I know how to work a chainsaw. He had no idea he wrecked the chainsaw, you know. Like, nobody told him, you have to be careful, it's dangerous, you know. But luckily it didn't work, because he put diesel in it. So that was the end, brand new chainsaw, end of story, you know. And I was like, wow, that's really incredible programming that everyone's got. He's a boy, so of course. He's born knowing how to work a chainsaw. That's really strong, no? It's amazing, the strength of all of these conditionings that keep us on this... I don't know what they're called. What are they called, Daniel? This thing, what's it called?
Huh? You're having playgrounds.
Yeah.
Like a roundabout.
Big roundabout.
Yeah, like a giant roundabout with walls that the humans stick to the walls.
Do you mean even in you have joy rides or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. I think some people do it with motorbikes even, don't they? And they drive like that, because there's the centrifugal force, you know?
For me, it resembles the vehicle in amusement parks.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Where you go inside and shut the door and you stay there. I haven't been there for a while.
Yeah.
They go really far, they're really big and they go up.
Up and round. But it's that thing that makes us stick to the walls, you know? Makes us stick to that, believing in this such a solid self from this, from our habits and programmings and stuff that we don't even realize, you know? Where we're coming from. And what we're not noticing. And then we can also see into that. It's not like a dire situation. We can see through it. And so sometimes these teachings on non-self can be seen as a very, I need to get rid of myself, you know? And people get into a kind of detached state where they get very distanced from their emotions, from a misunderstanding sometimes of those teachings. Because we still need to take care of ourselves and our feelings and our being in whatever state we're in, you know. We need to shine a really compassionate light on where we're at now. This being in this body, you know, with this programming, even if I'm seeing through the programming bit by bit, I'm only at where I'm at now, you know? And that needs a lot of care and love to be able to do that. It doesn't need will force or anything like that. It needs love, a lot of love. To be kind, because we keep getting on the on that one. So knowing slowly coming into awareness of the nutriments, you know, what feeds that. Because each of us are different. What food we're giving that sense of self can be really interesting. How we feed it. And slowly, not needing that food, bit by bit. And that feeling into emotions can, in meditation, we can do it all the time, you know, with the pleasant, unpleasant. We can be feeling, this unpleasant sensation. Is there meanness in there? This pleasant sensation, this thought, this craving. We can feel into that all the time in a light way. In an easy way, delicately, you know, so delicate, not rough-handed, because that's just giving ourselves a hard time, hey? And feeling that coming up of, yeah, but what about me? Yeah, but what about me? Me too, I need... And that's a really important... moment to be so awake, because in those moments of what about me, it can be really helpful to feel the sense of our perception of self, and it can be really important to listen as well to what we need in those moments, just to listen to, do I need care, you know, do I need to stand up for myself here? Is that, what about me? Can I gently say to the people around me, you know, respect me. These are my boundaries. Or, I need help, I need support, I need care. It's a big thing, you know, that being able to ask for help and care and stuff. For me, anyways, it's a big work. It's a big work. And it has been on this retreat, you know. I've had some rocky moments with my partner and needing to say, I need help. Can you support me? And finding how difficult it is, you know. Because of that thing of maybe some of us haven't had much care when we were children. We didn't have somebody who said, what do you need? Learn to express what you need. So there's these two things going on, huh? This exploration, on one hand, into non-self, and not believing the solidity of our perceptions, and on the other side, where do I need to ask for support, and love, and care, and take care of myself, and give that to myself, or know how to find it from other people? And that's where we're coming more into the form and the formless together, mixing. The formless being the seeing through non-self, and the form being this body in this time, in this moment, with this baggage, you know.
Can I say a comment?
Yeah, please.
How can I remember that when I go back home?
Tie a string around your finger or your wrist with a knot. No, really, really. And sometimes at the end of the day, maybe you'll go, why have I got that string? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Another way you can do is have some stones, some small nice stones in your pocket, or some marbles, something like that. I know this is more of a Tibetan way of doing things. To have something in your pocket that all day you kind of, yes, to remind you. Something like that. Look, Sumedha's got her little turtle here. That might help.
In that moment when you need it mostly.
Yeah. But I think it's like anything, it comes with becoming familiar with that exploration, you know? So first you come to retreats and you can explore that in these good conditions and do a few more retreats, and slowly from that you're beginning to become familiar with that exploration, so that after you can take it out of retreat. And then when somebody relates to you in a way that brings up the sense of self, something will go click, click. Yeah, yeah, sure.
But there are also lots of good Dharma talks, Dharma Sri, for example, even Ajahn Sumedha, Ajahn Amaro, both there.
Yeah, there's 2,600 years of Buddhist talks on non-self. That's just, I'm just saying it in the way I say it, but there's many ways of saying it, and yeah, yeah. I think I'm starting to go over the time. So, thank you for saying that, for asking. And we can come back to this subject, especially the dance of the form and the formless, which is actually the dance of life, isn't it? And how those two come together. We can come back to it for the rest of our lives. But on this retreat, we can come back to it, hey? This merry, merry dance. I'll find a poem here. I've got my torch here so that I can... <it's>... Don't get inflated now, just... No, I think this is going to work. This is a poem by Mary Oliver. A bit weird though, like that. Oh, there we go. Called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. So I'd like to dedicate our moment of listening and this sharing to our freedom. Thank you so much for listening and being here, so present.